Hey everyone, welcome to Alumless. So glad that you could join us. Thank you for listening. It is Friday, April 12th, and this is the Digital Advancement Exploration edition of the show. I'm Ryan Catherwood. I'm joined by Chris Marshall, founder and CEO of CMAC. Hey Chris, how's it going?
Good, Ryan. How are you?
Doing great. Happy Friday to you, of course. On the show, we talk about alumni engagement strategies in advancement, engagement more broadly, of course. We are live today, so please chime in with your questions or comments in LinkedIn. And be sure to say hello. If you're listening live, let us know where you are joining us from, and we are excited to have you. If you haven't already, pick up the podcast edition of Alumless by subscribing. You'll get the 30-minute bonus segment of the show featuring today's special guest, Andrew Gosin from Cornell University, and all of our guests each week. We would not be able to do the show without support from our friends at Protopia. Protopia has created a transformational AI-powered technology that matches questions from students or recent graduates with alumni all over the world that are perfectly positioned to answer those questions. Without asking alumni to be mentors or participate in programs spread out over a month or sign up for an app or platform, Protopia makes scaling introductions simple. Questions get submitted and Protopia's AI does all the work. Protopia can even target stakeholders like young alumni or lapsed donors and provide them with a meaningful volunteer experience. And who isn't trying to scale volunteerism? Visit protopia.co/alumless for more details and check out the technology that schools like LSE, Duke University, Florida State, some great schools using Protopia. If you haven't had a chance yet to check it out, you should definitely do so. All right. Well, I've been excited for today's show for just about months now since we had Andrew on the calendar. Andrew and I used to do a live show called Advancement Live almost 10 years ago now. We alternated co-hosting. We used a Google Hangouts on air app, which I don't think no longer exists anymore, which is kind of a fun thing.
How many episodes did that series run?
That's a good question. We did that probably for 3 or 4 years, I want to say. Couple of years, and we were doing a couple episodes, not too dissimilar to Alumless. You know, we would alternate weeks like this and kind of do maybe two a month alternating.
We're in our second year. We're closing on two at 48 episode with Andrew.
Yeah, episode 48 today, which is awesome. Who would have thought the little show? Now we have a theme music and some branding and some listeners. I was just checking out the analytics the other day, and it's great to see more and more people tuning in to Alumless and picking up the podcast. But Chris, on the last show, you mentioned actually when we were talking about talent and development of teams within advancements, that you were reflecting back on your work at Cornell University, and our today's guest, Andrew Gosin, you said that he was one of the best organizational decisions that you ever made, which was hiring Andrew. And we'll give him a hard time about that a little bit when we pop him up on the screen. Or maybe it's you we ought to be giving the hard, I don't know. But do you remember what was going on at the time that you were thinking about hiring a senior director for social media strategy? I guess that was like January of 2010 at that time.
Yeah, I'll never forget the conversation happened in November of 2009 on the way. It was like Wednesday before Thanksgiving. He can tell his version of the story, but my memory of it was we had three senior director vacancies. I was given the chance to grow the program and bring in a leadership team. Very fortunate opportunity. So I had three senior director roles, and they were sort of in traditional buckets. And Andrew and I went and recruited Andrew to apply for one of them and talked him into coming to campus. Came to campus, and we had dinner the night he was getting ready to leave. And he said to me, "I'm really, I would love to do this role. I love everything about it to get in Cornell. But what I really hope to do is X, Y, or Z." So we ended up having a conversation, and I said to him, "Andrew, we want you on the team one way or another. Why don't you write up a job description for what you would want as an ideal role?" And he did that. And he came back to me with it. We had a conversation on the Wednesday before Thanksgiving. And I'm not sure if he accepted the position then or we were talking about it then, but it wasn't long after that Andrew was joining the team and in a role that he helped create, senior director for social media strategy at the time.
Yeah. Well, thinking about social media, I mean, things have changed a lot over the last, 14 years since you hired Andrew. My first role in higher ed had social media in the title as well, which I think actually was kind of how Andrew and I ended up being connected together for that show. But we'll ask Andrew this question too, but what are some of the big issues that are shaping the way we think about marketing and communications and advancement?
Well, the first thing was the misnomer in his title when Andrew eventually said to me, social media is not a strategy. Social media is a channel, right? So we need to have a broader digital strategy, which so that's been proven true over and over and over again in my mind. But of course, Nowadays we're talking about artificial intelligence. There's a plethora of different social channels out there that we can choose from. Some are in vogue at different times and different audiences, different segments of our population are using different versions, different tools. The other thing I learned from Andrew is that what we are finding increasingly, and I think he'll have lots of data about this, is that online engagement will lead to offline engagement and vice versa. People that will engage with us online will show up at stuff and become volunteers, and people who are doing that kind of stuff will start to follow us on our social media channels too. So it's like a cycle, is how he's talked about it. And the last thing I'll say on this topic is that we saw a big spike in how we communicate digitally with our alumni during the pandemic. We had large numbers of alums engaging. Breadth of engagement increased significantly for almost every client we work with, where we saw more and more people showing up, first-time engagements and different diverse groups, young groups, and you name it. And then we went back, come out of the pandemic, we've gone back to our in-person strategies and our numbers are down, which is a lesson I don't think we learned fully. I'd love to hear Andrew's thoughts on that topic specifically, but we should go back to a little bit more of a hybrid environment, but it's also hard to manage those things for lots of reasons. But let's bring out the expert, though, instead of me talking about it. Let's hear from him.
Yeah, let's do it. All right, let's welcome Andrew Gosin to the show. Andrew is the Executive Director of Communications, Marketing, and Participation for the Office of Alumni Affairs and Development at Cornell University. Hey, Andrew.
Hey, Ryan. Hey, Chris. Great to see both of you.
Too. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for joining us. Yeah, it's been great to think back over the last 14 years, 10 years, several years, whatever, and think about the changes that have taken place. Actually, in preparing the show, Andrew, I was looking just at your job titles alone at Cornell as to sort of perhaps a way of telling something of the story around the evolution of advancement marketing and communications. First your job, Senior Director, Social Media Strategy. And of course, Chris just talked a little bit about, how and why that changed. So then you were Executive Director of Digital. Now you're Executive Director, Communications, Marketing, and Participation. But let's hear it from you. Like, how has your job changed and evolved over the years? And, what have those title changes meant in terms of how thinking may have changed?
Sure. I mean, I think big picture, it means that many of the things that Chris and I suspected back in 2010 when we drafted up that initial job description were actually right on point. The way it unfolded was that initially we had a very small team of two sitting within alumni affairs. We were defined as engagement staff, which made sense and actually was serendipitous in that there was a decision made 2010 or 2011. I'm sure you remember this, Chris, when a decision was made to move all of the alumni affairs and development communication staff off to university relations. And
yes,
they were theoretically going to be dedicated to AAD work, and that never pans out the way you expect it. And so, So my little team was sort of hidden from that because we were classified as engagement folks. Over time, we got the social media communities built out, and we started realizing that a lot of the same forces that were posing challenges on the engagement side were also inevitably going to wash up against the fundraising side. So we began to experiment with things like crowdfunding. Crowdfunding then led into the first Cornell Giving Day in 2015. And I think over time, the division realized that these social changes in communications behavior and where people were such that we couldn't ignore them. And at the same time, they realized that a lot of the sort of groundwork laying that my team and I had done was actually panning out and delivering positive results. At the same time, I was getting much better at explaining what we were trying to do in ways that didn't make people seize up and get really tense. So over time, I'd say we gradually began to serve a greater and greater portion of the frontline folks throughout the division. And then the most recent reorg, the one that resulted in the creation of the communications, marketing, and participation team, I think is sort of validation of all of the work we'd done for the prior decade, and that suddenly, instead of having to persuade people that they need to think about digital as an add-on to communications and engagement, we're actually now explicitly and unapologetically digital first. And that doesn't mean we're digital only. Don't get me wrong. There's still a room for print and for in-person stuff. But I think this really is a reflection that a lot of these calls were right. And it was interesting when the pandemic happened. That was actually the moment that the investment that you triggered, Chris, really paid dividends.
We were doing live streaming events back in 2011.
Right. So we knew how to do all this. We knew how to create engaging content. Right. And for us, the pivot was very easy because we've been walking this walk for years, and we had an experienced team built out that could handle this.
Yeah. So how does engagement fit into communications, marketing, and participation? You know, what is your role and your team's role in measuring engagement? What's important? What's not?
So I would actually flip the equation around and say that communications, marketing, and participation are all very important constitutive elements of engagement. We have a divisional growth dashboard that simultaneously serves to let us see where we've been in the past, but also we set goals for the current fiscal year. And the idea here is that this is a management tool. It's not just a retrospective reporting deal, but because we've set goals and we know where we were in April of last year with regard to engagement, we can tell where we are relative to our goals this year. And then we can intervene in time if there's intervention needed. But our formula for engagement is the classic alumni engagement index of volunteerism or giving or attending events. So there are two ramifications of that, one of which is that if giving is part of engagement and most of the donors are coming in through participation level giving, it makes total sense that participation level giving is very closely aligned with engagement efforts. The other piece is that we've created a sort of digital category that supplements the traditional giving, volunteering, attending events categories, which lets us begin to quantify and incorporate engagement that's primarily happening online. So I'm talking about things like social media activity on Facebook pages that we can track, engagement with email, activity on our websites, accessing digital downloads, that sort of thing. And I think that gives us a much greater sense of the overall footprint of engagement work than we would have had if we weren't positioned this way. The other interesting thing that's happened is that we're now reporting up through Alumni Affairs, which makes sense because our AVP, her pre-higher ed job was in sort of corporate communication. So she's got lots of expertise in this area. But an interesting side effect of that is that my leadership team and I now sit on the Alumni Affairs leadership team, which, of course, Chris, I'm sure you have fond memories of ALT meetings. But with all of these people who are handling the digital channels of the communications and the marketing for the engagement programs at the table with all of the people who are leading the engagement programs, it's a totally different conversation than if you're sitting in different verticals and you have to coordinate. You actually talk about things like how something's going to be marketed at the beginning of talking about it. When you talk about a big event and you're thinking about venues, you've got the people at the table who are going to ask, well, if there's going to be a hybrid dimension to this, what considerations do we need to take into account that guarantee that this will be just as good of an experience for the virtual audience as it is for the in-person audience? And I think that there is real, real strength in this structure. The other thing I'd really call out is that this puts you in a position to start asking really interesting questions about participation level giving behavior and engagement behavior and the interplay between those two things. In a way that, once again, is much more difficult if you don't have all these people having the same conversations at the same time and a commitment to the notion that we're all accountable for fundraising results, right? So being able to actually start asking those questions about the customer journey and the donor journey and how those may intersect with the engagement journey. And then you start folding in thinking about what marketing automation is going to make possible and AI tools. That's pretty exciting stuff.
So you can see why I say that Ender was my, my favorite hire of all the folks we've ever brought on the team. Because all my, I think I said this when we talked about it, Andrew, I'll embarrass you while you're on the screen. The best thing I did was bring him in and get out of the way and try to never say no to Andrew Goshen was my goal. Because all the things you've talked about are things that you brought to the equation. That's the management lesson there, is bring in good people and get out of the way. I have a question for you, but I want to just shout out to Kevin Wesley on the call. He said, say hi to me and to Andrew, send back from Stowe, Mass. But anybody else who's on live now, put in a comment, say hello, or tell us where you're listening in from, or ask a question. Now's the chance. We can ask it live here or follow up. So my next question, Andrew, for you is social media more or less important than it once was? And one of the most important, this is a little bit tactical, but give us some tips on one of the most important social media channels for today's advancement shop. What would you say we should be focused on?
So I would say it's still important, but it's important in a different way. It's great that everybody now recognizes that it's an important broadcast mechanism and that you can take advantage of algorithms to get content out there in front of a broader audience than you would if you were just pushing it out to exclusively owned channels. You know, it's pretty essential for things like managing PR crises and crisis response and so on and so forth. Yeah. Where I think things have changed is I don't feel as though the level of organic engagement that we used to see on social channels is still there anymore. And I think part of that has to do with the way that social media has become much more of a sort of place for partisan warfare and gotcha games since probably 2015. So, and very understandably, people don't want to stick their head out and then discover that whatever they said has been screen capped and 8 years later you get fired because of it, right? I think that's very natural level of caution. So on one level, it's sad for me that we had this really nice thing and then it turns out we can't have nice things because people exploit it. But on another level, it's a relief given how bumpy things were in the early years that everybody's pretty much now conceded that these are viable and important communication channels and they're staffing them appropriately.
I was going to ask Andrew, should we be having conversations with our alumni on social media? Like, should we be trying to drive that type of, you know,
it's a much dicier proposition than it used to be because one screen grab taken out of context and sent to the right sort of bot farm on Twitter can really wreck your day. I think it's a great place now for putting the official organizational position out there and being able to distribute that widely, but it's a merciless space these days.
Yeah.
We were going to ask you, given, you know, social media is different now, right? Myself, I've sort of noticed how I use and engage with short videos, shorts, you know, in a way that I never used to, you know, 10 years ago, wasn't even a thing. But now, you know, Instagram Reels and TikTok and Snapchat, they've really kind of changed the nature of the content on social media. But just for fun, I'm going to rattle off a few social media platforms. And I want you to tell me the first thing that comes to mind. All right.
Yep.
All right. Here we go. All right, Facebook.
I still like it because that's where my network is that I want to stay in touch with. But I recognize that that's not something the kids are doing. My kids certainly have no interest in Facebook.
Yeah. Instagram.
Love it. And I'm glad that Facebook hasn't screwed it up. They've been very smart in what aspect of Snapchat and TikTok they have copied and integrated into it. Like Reels. My big beef with Instagram is that Meta tied Threads to it. I would never voluntarily have connected my Instagram account to Threads. And the only times I have visited Threads since launch day are when it's sort of nestled in my feed in a deceptive way and I accidentally click through because I think it's an Instagram post.
100%. Yeah, 100%. All right, X, formerly known as Twitter.
I'm not as down on it as some. I don't think Elon Musk broke it. I think the community broke it, as I alluded to earlier, back when they decided this was a place to scream at each other. But I really miss the Twitter of 2010 through like 2014. I mean, Ryan, I think that's where you and I first actually connected, right? On the KSFMC hashtag. I think about people like Kim and Fanti, like these really, really good friends and colleagues who I've known for a decade now because we actually could have a civil, interesting conversation about things we cared about. And that's just much, much harder these days.
Snapchat.
I don't get it, but I know I'm not the audience and we've made design decisions that make sure that I never become the audience, right? I will say that it's clearly there are still kids there, right? And we've got some organized alumni groups who are sort of trying to stir up trouble. And we've recently learned that they're actually doing paid advertising on Snapchat, promoting their views. So it's clear that at least somebody views that as a great vehicle for communicating with a younger audience. I think if I were sitting in admissions instead of where I sit, I might view things differently. But from an alumni relations perspective or a personal perspective, it's not my cup of tea.
All right, two more. LinkedIn.
Surprisingly, LinkedIn is the biggest area of growth that we are seeing at Cornell. The main LinkedIn University page is actually run through university relations, not through my shop. But that's actually a place where we are getting good, positive, constructive engagement when we put information out about things that are happening on campus, and the audience is growing. So if the data indicates that that's a place to invest energy, I say invest energy.
Yeah, I'm with you on that one. All right, TikTok, and then we had a guest ask about WhatsApp.
TikTok. It's entertaining in small doses. Once again, not my cup of tea. I'm not totally convinced that it's a fantastic tool for strategic communication. I could see it for engagement. I think if I were doing recruiting of undergrads, I'd be pretty interested in it. But for the AAD audience, once again, it just doesn't seem like that's a fertile hunting ground.
Yeah. Yeah. And WhatsApp is another Meta product.
Right. So that tends to come up most frequently for us in the context of international alumni engagement and, you know, China, Europe, groups there that may or may not have staff in them. But a lot of the communities in these countries tend to use WhatsApp to organize their own activities. And clearly it's viable. And if you have good relations with your volunteers and there's something you really need shared, you can ask them to share it. And that's a pretty efficient broadcast mechanism.
Yeah.
Well, WhatsApp,
Chris, do you see? Oh, do you want to ask a question?
Real quick, internationally on WhatsApp, I have a client who was sharing that they had gone through all the traditional lengths to get people to show up at an event in London, emails and direct everything, text messaging. And they had one person who had a WhatsApp group of like 300 people, alums in the London metro area, sent it out, and registration, you know, they went from like three people to 200 people coming to the event through a WhatsApp post. Simple as that. Yeah. Because that was where people were going to pay attention. Simple as that.
I have a friend that lives in Chile and he keeps trying me to get me to download and communicate with him via WhatsApp because that's what the tool he uses with all of his networks. Well, Chris, where do you see our clients struggling the most when it comes to effectively using digital marketing and communications tools?
It's something that you pointed out a while back with a client, and we see it pretty regularly, Ryan. It's that sort of the voice that we're using and we're talking at and not having a conversation with. And Andrew pointed out some areas where it's hard to do that in certain social channels, but the more we can engage in a dialogue, feedback and forth with our alumni, the better off we're going to be using these channels. I think a lot of places are just constantly putting out and throwing things out, talking at the audience in a way that helps the university get a message out, but it's not meaningful to the audience in some way. So that's the one place I see the most struggling. How about you, Ryan? How about you or Andrew in your role?
Well, I was just sort of interested in like the phrasing around strategic communications, Andrew. The way that you may have been talking about it leads me to think that you're thinking about the messaging the university delivers to its alumni and donor base, and the clear messaging that it wants everybody to know, versus that messaging often does not beget very much engagement, right? It's you may post something and people will read the message, but they're not commenting or sharing necessarily at the same types of clip as other types of questions or other types of prompts, that might lend people to sort of participate more in that on the social media channel itself. So do you think, did I kind of get that right? Is that kind of the way that you think about like strategic communication?
That's what I mean when I say strategic communications, but I think that is very fundamentally linked to having good engagement. Because the point of engagement, in my opinion, is to build a relationship with your audience in such a way that when there's something you really need to get them to pay attention to, they're already primed to pay attention to it, right? And I think that means that if we want our audience to be ready and receptive and in the habit of opening our emails or paying attention to us when we pop up in their newsfeed, we'd better have a good track record of reaching them with things they're interested in that may be a little bit lighter or more fun. And I think that's where some people who approach these sorts of conversations from a pure strategic comms lens or sort of a PR lens oftentimes stumble because they're like, well, this is silly. Why in the world would you put this out there? Isn't that cheapening the brand? That sort of question. And I would argue absolutely not. What you're doing there is you're building up social capital and credibility in such a way that when there's a thing that's got to get there and it's got to land, people will pay attention because it's a relationship. It's not like you're appearing out of the blue and demanding that they pay attention to you.
Yeah, you all, with the leadership of Ashley Budd, do a tremendous job with engagement emails, right, that are written for the alumni with them in mind and the content that they'll find enjoyable and in a tone that they'll, engage with, interact with. It's really a fantastic approach that you all have there. All right, we sometimes do some fill in the blank questions here, Andrew, just to see what happens. So fill in the blank, answer this one. The most effective content strategies for university advancement teams are always blank.
Tailored to the audience and the channel.
Tailored to the audience and the channel. Yeah. So in other words, like the same thing that you post on Facebook should not go on LinkedIn.
You might have the same core of content appearing on both, but it ought to sound right for each channel, right? Because different channels have different cultures and different different norms and different things that make you sound like you know what you're doing. But then there are also types of content that you might put in front of one audience that you simply wouldn't put in another. We've been talking a lot about annual fund messaging recently, for instance, and we have lots of data suggesting that the traditional annual fund appeal that's sort of rooted in nostalgia and give back to the institution that gave back so much to you and that sort of angle. This is the resource that makes it possible for institutions to take advantage of opportunities. That approach that lands really well with some, and it lands disproportionately well with older generations. But at the same time, younger generations are much less receptive. And in some cases, they're actually turned off by that because it sounds like a very old school type of thing that maybe resonated with their father or their grandfather, but not so much them, or they've got issues with institutions in general, or they'd rather invest their philanthropy in things that have more tangible impact in their local communities. And you've just got to acknowledge that those two realities exist, and that if you want either audience to pay attention to you, you need to meet them where they are in the channels where they are. And I guess if we were to distill our philosophy as a work team, into one sentence, it's that we are working to get the right message in front of the right people at the right time and the right channel. And that if you do that consistently, you're going to end up with improved outcomes, whether you're raising money or you're trying to get people to invest themselves emotionally in the institution and volunteer and attend events.
Yeah. Yeah. Makes sense. So we were going to ask you about Cornell's giving day during the live show, but we've run out of time. So we're going to ask you about that in the podcast edition of the show, which will be fun. So everybody who's listening, if you want to hear Andrew talk about their fantastic annual day of giving, something he's been a forefront leader on for many years, back when you were hosting Advancement Live shows, interviewing the folks at Columbia about their approaches, you'll have to subscribe to the podcast in order to hear it. But all right, Chris, before we say goodbye, who is our guest in 2 weeks?
Show 49, Sally Sestair from Denison University. She's been in the role almost a year, and we're going to talk about what it's like taking on an alumni program at a liberal arts college with a career twist, is how the president describes what Denison does day to day. It's a really interesting place, and Sally had the good fortune in many ways. Andrew, it reminds me of the investment that Charlie made back in 2009-10, where he brought all these people in. Sally's had a chance to build a team and double her FTEs count, and it's been really interesting to watch. Still early on, but we're going to talk to her about that journey. It'll be interesting.
All right. Well, thanks to Max Slyston and the team at Protopia for being our presenting sponsor, for Andrew and for Chris. Thanks, everybody, for listening. We're going to say goodbye for today and record our bonus segment for the podcast edition. So we'll see you in 2 weeks' time with Sally from Denison. And thanks so much for joining us today. Bye, everybody.
Hey, listeners. Chris and I were going to record an ad discussing all the great aspects of Protopia, of which there are many. But instead, we thought it would be even better to hear from one of Protopia's current partners. Here's Sally Sestair, Executive Director of Alumni Engagement at Denison University, talking about her experience with the technology. If you like what you hear, be sure to go to protopia.co/alumlus and check it out. How do you see Protopia fitting into your plans? You mentioned a few ways that I might imagine it fitting in, but what do you think?
It's a tremendous fit. Listen, I cannot tell you how excited I was when I took this job to know that they already had Protopia, right? It's a very, very smart decision. Because one, it just, you know, it with the AI technology enabled, like it takes us out of the equation, right? It is really a great tool for alumni and students to ask those questions and be connected to, you know, the top experts, right, or the top individuals to answer those questions for them. What I've been really excited to hear about here at Denison is, you know, if that question goes to five alumni, well, all five of our graduates are answering. And then it gets into, you know, like a train of communications between them and the individual asking the question. So it's really facilitating community for us in a way that we couldn't do that ourselves if we were at the helm of trying to, you know, facilitate someone's question going to those individuals, right? It's just, it's automatic, and that's the beauty of it. The other thing I would say to you is that it is also, it's bringing people into, it's engaging alumni that may not have engaged with us in any other way, right? But they really are appreciative that, you know, they get an opportunity to help another alumni member or help a student. So I can't say enough great things about what a difference maker that has been for us on the engagement level.
All right. Welcome back. Thank you for subscribing to the podcast edition of Alumlus. So glad that you could join. We have returned with Andrew Gosin, Executive Director, Marketing Communications and Participation at Cornell University's Office of Alumni and Development. Had a great conversation this first 30 minutes live on LinkedIn and YouTube. So thanks for those who joined us live. But we didn't get a chance to talk a lot about Giving Day at Cornell, which I know is a huge initiative there and one that you all have been really successful with. over the last few years, raising incredible amounts of money. So maybe you could just share a little bit about your work at Cornell around Giving Day and the formula that you've used over the years to keep it fresh and to keep the community more involved, to make sure everyone's accustomed to it being on the calendar and supporting it, effectively making it a tradition at the university, which it seems to be at this point. Maybe just talk about how to make it so awesome year after year and keeping it fresh.
Sure. I guess to start with, it was exciting for us this year because this was actually our 10th Giving Day.
That's right.
The first was in 2015 as part of the Cornell sesquicentennial. So making it through 10 has been pretty cool. And we don't have all of the gifts loaded into the system yet in such a way that I can give a definitive total we've raised over the course of those 10 years. But my suspicion is it's going to end up being somewhere between $80 and $90 million. Which is pretty awesome. You know, we were talking in the live show about how much skepticism there was about this type of work early on. And I think this is a pretty convincing rebuttal to those, those early fears. Right.
Yeah.
So I'd say there are two things that we have done with Giving Day that have helped us keep it fresh. And I'm aware that there are conversations out there about have Giving Days run their course. I don't think they have. But I recognize that if you're just doing the same thing year after year and you don't know why you're doing it, they could get to feel pretty stale pretty fast. So the first thing is we actually have a very good sense of why we do a Giving Day at Cornell. And the reason we do it is because this is our primary acquisition vehicle for new alumni donors and for student donors. And because of that, well, the dollars are great. Our real metric is those donor numbers, right? This is a donor exercise. So because that's our approach, that means that we have not gone down other paths that other schools have gone down. And I certainly don't mean to criticize them for doing that because their decisions probably make sense for them. But for instance, we decided very early on that this was not going to be a situation where it's really important that the numbers get bigger and bigger every year and sound more and more impressive, right? There was concern that Giving Day could, if you went in that direction, begin to distort conversations that are happening at the major gift or the principal gift level in ways that wouldn't be constructive. So we decided we're just not going to put pressure on ourselves to make sure that we're getting up into the, you know, we're north of 10 million now, and that's fabulous. But will we ever be north of 20 million for Giving Day? Probably not, because that's not the game we're playing. But I think knowing what you're trying to accomplish makes it much easier to assess how well what you just did worked. And if it didn't work the way you hoped, you can make adjustments. And then that leads into the second thing, which is that we very self-consciously treat Giving Day as a lab to experiment with new engagement ideas and new approaches. This year, the experiment was, it was Pi Day. This was a Pi Day Giving Day. So March 14th, the team came up with an idea for a video game that was sort of an old school 8-bit side scroller video game, like Defender or some of those other early 80s games where you've got the little thing and you're trying to navigate it through obstacles as the screen moves on by. Right. So the concept that they came up with was that Touchdown, who's Cornell's unofficial mascot, a little bear, was trying to navigate through this. Basically, it's like a series of stalactites and stalagmites through a big cave. And then every now and then, Touchdown would be able to get a piece of pie. And at the end of the game, the user could take however many pies had been earned and then designate those to one of the annual funds of the participating colleges and units, right? And then on Giving Day itself, we had an actual real pot of money, and the colleges, the top five on the leaderboard, got a portion of that pot based on how many pies they'd been given during the process of the 2-week marketing window and then Giving Day itself, right? So that's like a really clever and engaging way of connecting this engagement activity, this digital engagement activity, to Giving Day in a way that people can participate without necessarily having to make a gift.
But how many people were involved in that phase?
In the development or in the
Well, no, the alumni actually using, playing the game, basically. What was it?
As of the end of Giving Day itself, 30,000 plays.
Oh, my God. How many unique people do you know?
That probably wasn't unique. We can't reduce it to the unique number.
It's not you. Well,
the difference between the duration of an average visit to the site from last year, it was a full minute. Right. So people were clearly playing it. A minute of attention, you can barely put a value on that. Like, that's amazing in today's digital environment, right? So we would never in a million years have experimented with that if we didn't have Giving Day as this great big public campaign where we're trying to drive engagement. Last year's version of this was a sort of BuzzFeed style personality quiz where people went through a whole series of questions, and then it would tell you your donor personality type, and then a series of funds that were associated with that. So people could play the game and then be served these ideas that appear to reflect their philanthropic interests. We've done live streams in the past. Chris, I'm sure you remember the legendary 24-hour live streams, right? So that was where we learned to do the stuff that as we were discussing on the live show, positioned us to shift very easily into pandemic mode because we've been doing this for a decade, right? So that puts a whole different lens on the value of a Giving Day, in that if this is where you can develop these new capabilities, which you can then deploy in other contexts, your organization is deriving value that has nothing to do with the dollars and the donors and the gifts on the day itself, but just in terms of your organizational competency. It's a fabulous, fabulous learning opportunity.
That's, I like, awesome. The concept of a lab to try new. I love that concept. It's really cool.
And it really does come down to, you know, being innovative each year on the non-giving component of the Giving Day, right? It's the engagement with content, the engagement with something that's interactive, right? Something that excites and makes people smile, right? And drives, like, Cindy Frederick used to use a phrase, surprise and delight factor, mm-hmm. right? At UVA, there's something special there that makes people feel good and smile. But I guess, you know, I wanted to circle back to, you mentioned, we brought up AI in the live show. And I remember years ago now, Andrew, I'm not exactly sure when it was, maybe in the 2016-15 era, you actually hosted a conference at Cornell on the subject of AI in advancement, kind of well before there was much in the way of advancement in AI or AI in advancement. And so how do you think about it now? How have you instructed your team to be using it? Like, what is a sophisticated team like Cornell? How are you all thinking about AI?
Yeah, that's interesting. That was February of 2018.
2018.
So,
okay.
4 years ago. And it's amazing how much the conversation has evolved since then. And I think the real difference is that back then this was a very abstract conversation. It was sort of like you can see that the horizon is getting a little bit lighter, right? And that it's coming. And if there's one thing that I've learned from social media, it's that it's far easier to get out in front of a seismic change like this than it is to try to catch up. Once it's happened, you want to sort of happen to it as opposed to having it happen to you. But it was hard putting together the content for that conference, and that there were very few people who were not academics who could actually talk about the application of AI in business context, period, much less advancement. And now I think the pendulum has swung completely in the opposite direction. I think we're actually probably at the peak of the hype cycle. I don't know what your Facebook and LinkedIn feeds look like, but there are, I don't know, I probably see 100 different opportunities to learn about generative AI a day. And I'm sure 10% of them are probably totally legit, and 30% are halfway informed, and the rest are probably snake oil. But it's now not abstract, and you've got more and more people who are focusing on the potential applications. I've actually just started doing a certificate program through eCornell, because I feel like there's so much hype and so much snake oil that I want to make sure that I've got a solid grounding in what the concepts actually mean and where we actually are. So then let's loop that back to your question, Ryan. I think we are beginning to think about it very seriously here at Cornell, and we recognize that we have to. We recognize that if we don't provide people with guidelines, one of the dangers of the emergence of something like a ChatGPT that's actually available to the broader public is that smart, curious staff members are naturally going to ask, how could this help me in my work? And they may not be fully aware of the ways that they can get themselves into trouble if, for instance, you take personally identifiable donor information and you put it into ChatGPT, and then that gets pumped out to God knows where on the internet. That would be a real problem, right? So we've been working to try to provide people with a set of guidelines for safe experimentation. We recognize that people need to try it out to be able to understand what the actual business applications are. I was involved with the group that put together the series of guidelines for communicators at Cornell. There was an episode at Vanderbilt, I think, probably a year ago at this point, where there was a thing that happened at a different college, and the Department of Student Affairs felt the need to send a message of sympathy to their undergraduates. And it was clear that it had been generated by ChatGPT, and then there was a great big PR crisis, and no one needs that, right? So in the communicators context, we were trying to just get people to be aware of the hazards of experimenting with these tools if you then take the output and you use it in a way that's not super thoughtful. So we're working on something similar for alumni affairs and development. And I think the interesting thing in these conversations is that we've realized that it's a losing battle to try to specify you should use a particular tool in a particular way. These tools are evolving so rapidly that any guideline that's that granular would be out of date almost overnight. What you can do is you can make the point that a lot of the policies that we already have in place that are well understood still pertain, even if generative AI is in the picture, right? You are still accountable for the work that you produce. And if you've generated the core of a solicitation email, for instance, using ChatGPT, and then you go in and you tailor it to your campaign and your audience, that's totally fine, right? But if you use it and you don't take that step to validate the fact that it's the appropriate thing for this campaign and this audience, and there's a problem, then you've committed a pretty significant violation of what we expect in terms of your work product and responsibility for your work product. But I think that's the right lens in something that's moving this fast. The principles are still the same. Your responsibilities are still the same. You shouldn't be stupid about things, but as long as you keep these in mind, you can do some experimentation. And I really think the way we're going to figure this out as an industry is if you've got lots of people experimenting in little pockets who are talking to each other and sharing what they're learning in such a way that we're basically crowdsourcing, figuring this out, as opposed to everybody trying to do it on their own and reinventing the wheel over and over.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. Responsibility for the quality of your work product, right? AI cannot write everything that we do, right? But could you use it to start something, to generate some ideas, right? I think that's what it's for, right? And if we're not using
what it does, right?
Yeah, there are clearly some things that are just completely out of balance. So like deep fake videos featuring senior academic leadership, no.
Yeah,
that's never going to be okay, right? Yeah. And then you've got much more mid-range concerns, like is it or is it not appropriate to use images that have been either generated by AI or substantially altered? I think where we came down with that is that if it's done in such a way that a person could misperceive what the original photo was, that you probably want to indicate that it's been altered by AI. But that's okay. I mean, as long as you're being transparent about the fact that you used a tool, that's great. Yeah. But if all you're doing is using it to touch up a photo a little bit and smooth things out, make the background colors pop better, like that's fine. But as a society, we've conceded that battle a long time ago, like ever since you started seeing filters on Instagram and stuff like that.
It's so, kind of just being clear, right? And being a bit transparent. Don't be fake about the use of it. And
exactly.
Well, Chris, what would you add to the conversation around, you know, our client work and how alumni teams are thinking about AI?
But I would add nothing in the context of being in front of Andrew on this conversation because he knows everything. If I had to talk about what clients are thinking about, I had a little bit more than Andrew on that topic because I've talked to several hundred clients. And I would say that generally speaking, July of 2023, I spoke at a conference and I was a moderator of a panel of artificial intelligence in alumni engagement. And interestingly, I went on ChatGPT and put in, what questions should I ask a panel? And they gave me 9 questions that were perfect. So I used them verbatim because it was so scary how good it was. But in the opening to that discussion, I asked 80 alumni relations professionals from the Northeast, how many people are using artificial intelligence right now in your day-to-day work? And not a single hand went up. And they said, how many people here have used ChatGPT before? And I think 2 hands went up in the room. This is July of 2023. So my response to what's happening with clients is more, you know, not quite a year ago, head in the sand aversion to going down this path. And there's some pioneers like Andrew who are thinking about it, as far back as 2018. Although I did learn, Andrew, that artificial intelligence, generative AI dates back 50 years. And I was shocked when I heard this at a panel discussion recently. It was amazing how long it's been around.
And I've been boring my family with all these things I've been encountering in this certificate program. But the course is actually taught by Sumitra Dutta, who's the former dean of the College of Business here at Cornell, who's now the dean of the College of Business at Oxford, right? And there was a segment where he was talking through the history of AI, and he was making the point that there were actually explosions of interest in the 80s and the 90s. That ended up not having the impact it did now. And at that point in time, it was interesting because the conceptual framework was there. Like the academics thinking about AI understood things like neural nets and deep learning, but the cost of computing power, it was incredibly slow and it was incredibly expensive, right? Yeah. So in both of those cases, it sort of died out. But then in the early 2000s, you had the combination of an increasingly sophisticated understanding of the theory, and then you had processing power becoming much cheaper.
Right, yeah, right.
You could iterate and you could experiment and try things out, and then that naturally led into the emergence of business applications. So things like that's when you start hearing about self-driving cars, right. And then this also coincided with the emergence on the net of these like massive open source data sets of things like images that you can use to train a self-driving car, right? So those four things all had to happen at the same time for us to end up where we are now. And I was just totally fascinated to hear that there had been these sort of false dawns in the 80s and 90s that didn't actually
happen. Yeah. I was down at Rollins and they did a panel on AI. They have a pretty sophisticated center there on this topic. And they had some really cool, COO from Meta and these great speakers. And what, so back into the late 70s, they were thinking about these same issues. But interestingly, that my story about the conference I spoke at in July of 23, I'm speaking at it again in July or August 1st of 24. I'm going to ask the audience, my topic is different, but I'm going to ask the audience to do a show of hands and see if the trend is any different. My N of 80 or 90 people, we'll see if they have more hands up. But
you should also ask a question about, do you use something that everybody uses that actually has AI in it, but they may not be aware that it has AI in it?
Yeah, it's a great point.
And your point could be, you're actually using it already.
Using it.
Yeah. You just don't know it. And the sun has still
Alexa,
you know, all good. Exactly. Yeah.
Alexa. Exactly. Yeah. How many people use AI? No hands. How many people use Alexa? Everyone puts their hand up. You're all using AI, right?
Yeah.
The machine learning and the training of machines to be responsive to queries. Right. And it's all really interesting stuff. I wanted to, before we do our last section, Andrew, which is our Friday Cheers section, where we talk about some things that are important to us that are not advancement related, I want to spend a couple of minutes just talking about a few of the other tools that are sort of in this realm of, you know, marketing, communications, participation that I often find, university is kind of struggling with what to do about it, whether these tools are worth their time at this point. So those three tools are apps, university specific app, you know, which might be a tool for sharing news, or what do you think about university specific branded apps? Network platforms. There's a lot of them out there. They've been a part of the conversation around sort of digital engagement the last 15 years. There's a number of companies involved there. What do you think of those? And online directories is kind of a tangential connect, you know, related to network platforms. But are these valuable tools? Do you use them at Cornell? What do you think?
He's being really careful.
They could be valuable, but they frequently are not.
Yeah.
And in all three cases, really, I think the burden to deliver value that is on the institution is pretty high. I was looking at your list of questions you submitted in advance, and I was trying to remember when was the last time I actually put an app on my phone. And it's been a long time. And there are a lot of apps I've weeded off because they don't give me anything that I need. So it feels to me like to ask somebody to install an institution-specific app on your phone and pay attention to it on a regular basis. I mean, you might open it once because of curiosity, but that bar is pretty high. So you better have a plan for how you're going to feed that thing and make sure that it is constantly providing value, or else I just don't think it's going to have much of an impact on your engagement efforts. It's a similar answer for these directories. Now, I think they have become more valuable as people have become less inclined to engage with each other on the social networks for reasons we talked about in the live show. Just the increasing sort of weaponization of what people have said, taking stuff out of context, sort of partisan groups wanting to use these conversations to yell at each other and score points instead of talk about things in a more collegial and productive way. So I think within the walled garden of some of these communities, if there are enough people there, you can see some pretty good conversation going on. It's not an exact analogy, but we probably a year and a half ago at this point, we launched a new digital publication for alumni at Cornell. It's called Cornellians. And that was the first time in Cornell history that we put a capacity for comments under articles on a university web property. I don't even want to, you can imagine the sort of pearl clutching that was involved in people thinking through whether that was appropriate or not. But the beauty there is that we put all sorts of safeguards in place, and each comment is actually manually approved. That was sort of the condition that we had to agree to be given the green light to do this. There have been some really lovely conversations across the generations in response to some of these articles that have been published by Cornellians. So, for instance, there was a big feature that was one of the top performers last year that was on restaurants in college town and historical restaurants. And then the prompt was, well, you tell us about your favorite experiences with restaurants in college town, whether it was 1950 or whether it was 2018. And seeing all these people from the class of 53 talking with the students who just graduated, I guess they're not students anymore, but alums from 2018, 2019, that's cool engagement, right? That can obviously happen inside a walled garden. But with the walled gardens, I've always felt like the sticking point is getting enough of a critical mass of activity that it can sustain itself. And if people show up and no one's there, they're not going to come
back. The same as last time, right?
Yeah. But if it takes off, it can be fabulous. It's just when you strategize about launching a walled garden, you really have to think about how you're going to get people in there and then how you're going to sort of seed activity in such a way that you get like a self-sustaining critical reaction going on.
If someone is listening to this podcast and about 200 people listen to each episode and you have a walled garden that is taking off, that has taken off, I want you to write me so I can hear about how you did it.
I bet you have no response to this, right?
I can actually tell you, there are two examples that I can cite of walled gardens that actually worked, but neither of them are pure US-based alumni affairs use cases. So one was a private business school in Germany where people would very explicitly post positions that were only available within the walled garden. Right. So there's no legal requirement in these cases to post it broadly. Part of the value proposition was there are jobs that are only available to people who are part of the alumni community and can only be found within here. And boy, that gets people logging in and checking on a regular basis.
Wow. Yeah.
The other was sort of an alumni group, but it was for a halfway house. And so there you had a community that had been through something pretty intense together.
Sure. Shared
experience. Meeting privacy, but still wanted to stay in touch. And that's a perfect use case for when a wall community really is delivering value that you can't find any other place. But I have
specific, right, with real value inside sort of a more micro community. Yeah.
Well, I think the value that's driving it.
Yeah. Yeah. And you got to have volunteers that are dedicated to growing it, right? Mm-hmm. To making it something special. All right. So Friday Cheers, Andrew, is when we like to talk about an app, an article, a book, a movie, something that you've done, anything that comes to mind. May not be advancement related, but it's got you thinking this week. What is your Friday Cheers?
My Friday Cheers is actually, it's a video game that was released about 2 months ago called Helldivers 2. And the basic premise is that there is this incredibly militaristic super Earth that is fighting multiple alien races on multiple planets. And it's like this massive online multiplayer game. I'm playing it because my kids and my nephew are playing it. And it's a good way to hang out with them and do stuff. It's like if you're a sci-fi fan, it's like all of your favorite movies come to life, like Starship Troopers, Aliens, all the Star Wars movies. It's tremendously fun and it's super satirical. But the thing that I'm really enjoying about it that I hadn't seen before and that's actually making me think about some advancement related stuff is that in this particular game, there's a person on the developers team who is shaping the story in real time in response to what the community is doing. And this is a big community of folks, right? So last Sunday morning, there were 370,000 people active online at the same time working on the day's mission. But the interesting thing is that then this guy, Joel, and I don't know if Joel is a real person. I don't know if Joel is a screen name for a whole bunch of different people. I don't know if Joel is an AI, but keeps throwing in the curveballs, all of which fit within this kind of broader sci-fi universe in a way that the community is just super excited about, right? So as of Sunday morning, everybody thought that the automatons had been pushed back, but it turns out that was the Vanguard. Tuesday morning, there's a much bigger invasion fleet coming and they're attacking from behind, right? So everybody's like, oh my God, and they go piling on over to deal with that. So there's a literary theory-esque kind of term for this. It's called emergent storytelling, where you're sort of inventing the story in real time based on what the community collectively is doing. And the way this ties into advancement for me, two different ways. One of which is that I think fundamentally, as advancement pros, we are trying to sell a narrative about our institutions and about how our constituents fit into the institutions in ways that inspires our constituents to want to support it, right? And you look at other areas where narrative is really important at getting people engaged, things like sports teams, sports seasons, people plug in and they can follow every twist and turn in the path during the season. And then if it ends up turning out well, you're happier than you've ever been. And if you fall short, next season is our season, right? That's a really effective self-contained narrative device that lets people plug into things. And that can happen sometimes in the context of higher ed. Chris, I'm sure you remember when Cornell went to the final, you were in Final Four. It was Sweet 16 in 2010.
16, yeah.
Now all these people who normally are disengaged were suddenly right there because this was this big, big, interesting opportunity to plug into Cornell in a way that they normally don't. So there's that narrative piece. But then what's also interesting is the way the community is responding to the narrative. And there are some people who are 100% bought into this. And as soon as the order hits, boom, they're off doing what they're being asked to do. There are other people who only plug in when something really exciting and attention catching, like this surprise attack from behind Neptune or wherever, pops up. And then there's also a contingent that has no interest in this whatsoever, and they just want to do their own thing. And then inside the community, you've got people beginning to fight over it, and the hardcore folks being like, why are you people not doing what you're supposed to do? Like, we need to come over there and sort you out, traitors. This got me interested, because you think about how hard we work as advancement professionals to get people to do the things that the institution needs to have done. And you've got that group of loyal folks who are going to do whatever we need them to do anytime they ask. Then you've got those folks who will tune in occasionally in the context of like a Sweet 16 or something like a campaign, because I think a campaign is a device to get people to focus for a short term around something really exciting. And then there are those other folks who just want to do their own thing within the space, but they're not interested in jumping when we say jump. And I'm really interested in that opportunity with those folks who are there, but they're not engaging. What are the things we might be able to do with them if we were able to figure out something meaningful and exciting to get them to dial into the broader narrative?
It's
actually going to make it possible to explore that in a way we couldn't before.
Yep.
Because if we can use AI to generate different content types and approaches, and we don't have to spend human time doing that, if we throw enough stuff at the wall, eventually some stuff is going to stick for some audiences. And then just imagine what a difference it would make if we could bump response rates or engagement rates or giving rates by even 2 or 3 percentage points, because suddenly we figured out something that works for these subpopulations. So that's a long and circuitous.
My takeaway from all that, Andrew, is I just love how your brain works. That was such a cool story.
Well, and I wonder whether video games, we could have, talk about this, we're running low on time here, but I wonder whether there's an opportunity for video games to be a common denominator that bring alumni together, right? A Fortnite tournament, easy, medium and expert level, right? I don't know, our different video games. So that's where young folks are, right? Or even not.
It's something they want. I mean, the very first thing I ever wrote about digital in advancement was actually a guest blog post for Andy Shamlin when Alumni Futures was going on back in, this was like 2008 or 2009. And there was this online game that was a version of Risk that was,
I remember that. I remember that
just there. Being played by students of the Ivies. And the students quickly realized that alumni also had .edu addresses that would get them in there. So on a daily basis, everybody would coordinate their activity and try to surprise other people. And the thing that blew my mind was that we had put so much time and energy into trying to generate online engagement with very minimal success. And I initially went to check this thing out. It was called Go Cross Campus because I thought it was the stupidest thing I'd ever heard. but then I looked at the chat boards and it's like tens of thousands of messages, and it was the alumni community gathering in the name of the institution and doing something together that we've been working so hard at, but we just hadn't been offering them anything they wanted to do. And they really wanted to do this. And I feel like that's the puzzle I'm trying to figure out, is what are the things that we could offer to them that they want to do that also align with institutional goals and institutional advancement.
Awesome. Chris, follow that up. No. What's your Friday cheers?
I'll be really quick, but if we can, I'll dive into it in another session. But today we're visiting a school for my daughter, and my water cooler topic is early childhood education and the importance of early intervention around neurodivergence. Our daughter has some issues in learning, and we've moved her to a different school. We're going to check out a new one right now. That's where I'm going right now. And I would love to talk more about it once I've had the experience. But that's what's on my mind right now with the water cooler is getting my 11-year-old daughter on the right path.
Yeah. Well, I'll bring a book. I had a chance to go on a awesome vacation last week. I was in Turks and Caicos. And so I had the opportunity on the plane and there laying around to read a novel. And I've been trying to read some of the Pulitzer Prize winning works. And this one I've been waiting for at the library, and I got tired of waiting, so I just bought it. But it's called Demon Copperhead by Barbara Kingsolver. And it's just this amazing writing that is told in first person perspective of this boy roughly following the ages of sort of fifth grade through high school, where he's orphaned early in the book, and you follow along his pathway in rural Virginia, sort of near the Tennessee border, and the culture and the descriptions of his involvement with other kids at school and playing football and how important that is. And the opioid pandemic, enters the scene, and it's ugly, and it's just a tremendously well-written book. I found myself laughing out loud with a lot of the writing, which I don't often do when I read books, but this was I found myself like picking out passages and reading them to my wife, which were on when we were on vacation. Just was like, you got to listen to this. Like this is just the funniest thing. And the language is sometimes a little crass, but it's just right on in terms of how you would imagine a young boy in that sort of part of the country speaking.
Time frame is it set in?
It takes place in the early 2000s, through the 2000s. So it's historical, but not much, right? It's modern day. But
cool.
Yeah. So all right. Well, thanks everybody for listening. Andrew, thank you so much for your time and your insights, awesome. Your expertise. Really great to have you on Alumlist this week. We're grateful for your.
I predicted this will be the most watched Alumlist episode.
Yeah, well, it very well might be. Hopefully listened to as well. And Chris, always good to see you. We'll probably be talking before the day is out on another matter of one sort or another. Sure. But Andrew, hopefully not too much more, because you are going to Hawaii next week.
Even tomorrow.
Ooh, nice.
Yeah.
I have to go see a client on Maui, Andrew. It's really a tough gig. I got to do it. Though.
Someone's got to do it.
Client on Maui. Sounds like you're doing something right.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you, everybody, for tuning in. We'll see you in 2 weeks. Bye.